The work of this church in the world is realized through the generous financial support of all who call this place home. Along with the gifts and time and talent, ours is a shared ministry. You have a role to play here. Church membership is open to all. For more information, go to uusf.org.
A Zen master, when asked to explain the Buddhist principle of impermanence, gently picked up his favorite teacup, held it, and declared, "For me, the cup is already broken." My husband and I heard a version of that years ago. If you buy a bowl, imagine it broken. And it's insinuated it into so much of what we say and do around our household. We've seized on it around the impermanence of everything, for sure. We fill our house with things we find beautiful and soulful, often handmade things, and yet each time we do something, we say, buy something or bring something in that's a gift, we say, beautiful, imagine it broken. When it breaks, we are a little more prepared. And the lesson is larger, of course. We practice with a bowl, a teacup, a bouquet of flowers, tiny material rituals of the celebrating and the letting go that life requires of us again and again and again. I'm not sure you would call either of us unattached, though, or non-attached. To some things, yes, we intentionally buy a car so functional and ordinary that we agree we won't fret about it getting dinged. In fact, years ago, in a Tony suburb of New Jersey, we once waved off a man who drove a brand new BMW SUV who had dented our bumper, telling him, "It's okay, it's fine, don't worry about it." He looked baffled and then practically ran to his car, and literally the tires squeaked as he hit the accelerator, as if he was afraid we would change our minds. We are intentionally non-attached to some things. Bowls, cars. In other ways, though, non-attachment is a work in progress for us. And the grief of something cherished and lost is so much harder to wave off sometimes. This week, for instance, in the universe's divine plan, our daughter Lila went back for her final year of college. Mind you, I've had 3 years of preparation for this particular moment, and yet I felt bereft. Do you know that bereft feeling I'm describing for yourself? It isn't logical. I mean, she'll be back at Thanksgiving, and I can talk to her every day if I want, and she chooses to answer her phone. It's healthy, it's normal, right, that she's doing the things she's doing, and I should be celebrating her progress. But those thoughts in this moment are belied by the clenching in my chest and the sick feeling in the pit of my stomach the entire day, by the deep grief that only gradually, day by day, is getting a little lighter. And to add to that, my spouse got on a plane on Thursday to fly to India to see his father. And all I could say to them each was, "You're leaving me! I'm alone!" And sure, each grief is a little different. The grief about Lila, though, it has a legitimate mournful charge to it. It's not just me being a drama queen. It's me being awake to what's going on in my life. She's almost launched, potentially. The clock is certainly ticking. My heart knows the truth and the weight of the fact that there aren't so many times more that I will have her returning to live in my home again. And Rohit, waken the tree spirit gods, the wood gods, he'll be back in a week. But having him gone, each time he's gone, for me, makes palpable the reality I try not to think about, the reality that one day one of us will be living without the other. It is a reality I find sadly not unimaginable, because if it were unimaginable, I would be saved a lot of grief, but terrifying. When Raymond Chandler, the author, wrote, "To say goodbye is to die a little," he spoke a truth I know in my gut and chest. All goodbyes are endings, some just bigger than others, and some presage others. Aditi did a gorgeous TED Talk on her work. You should find it. 20 minutes of solid wisdom on death and dying. She talks at one point about the need to practice leaning into and befriending, though she doesn't use that word, but that's what it brought up for me, befriending small deaths in life. The small parting moments. All the changes that involve letting go of one chapter, one project, one version of ourself, one place, to open up to what follows. In life, in this life where everything is impermanent, there are so many such opportunities to practice leaning into grief, aren't there? And loss, transition, which is always involves some grief, hopefully some joy or new beginning. Richard Holloway, a well-known bishop and leader of the Episcopal Church in Scotland, wrote a book, Waiting for the Bus, Reflections on Life and Death. And in it, he writes about the grieving that he did, that he first remembers as a grief of a transition when he started balding at a young age. And at a time when there were no medicines or cosmetic procedures to either stop or reverse balding. It was this grappling, this first grappling with aging and all of the losses of aging. Our bodies are thresholds of change and places to practice letting go. Job changes are thresholds. Marriages and divorces are thresholds. Falling in and out of love is a set of thresholds. Having children is a threshold. Having pets arrive and letting them go, those are thresholds. Even if you think about it, going on vacation and then getting to the point where vacation is over and you transition back to life is a threshold of grief and hopefully of some fond expectations, things we take with us. And each of these, each is a preparation. If we lean into it, each is a preparation for the larger griefs. So when they come, our arms are hopefully strong enough to hold them from practice. And our hearts are ready maybe to open from practice, open to these places rather than clenching, and find in these places in our life invitations to depth, to the wisdom they hold in them, to opportunities to grow in compassion. All of these invitations to growth and healing can be found in these thresholds. Parting is dying a little, but it's a part of life, and it's also an opportunity to grow. I wonder, I was thinking, by the way, whether the butterfly mourns some things that it left behind in its life as a caterpillar. And as a metaphor, whether it misses it so much in the beginning that it loses some of the brief joy that it has and the opportunity to see life from a new place, aloft on wings. So what does it mean then, friends, to befriend grief and lean into transitions? I think for each of us, we'll discover that on our own, follow the lead of our heart and spirit. For me, this week in particular, it's meant leaning into all the feelings, feeling them, not resisting them, crying, calling friends to share what felt silly and real at the same time, making them all promise, as I did, not to die before me, and after they stopped laughing to say, okay, but I mean it, promise me you won't die before I do. For me, I've learned that grief, even things like the end of a church year, make me want to clean and organize things. So this week, I gave in to the sudden need to clean the pantry, the linen closet, do all the laundry. Please come over this week and open all the doors. And I don't know why it feels important, but I've learned to surrender to it. And in the midst of it, I wonder, is this an attempt to control everything I can? Because so much that I love is beyond my control? Is this a desire to stay in motion and distracted till the pain lessens as it does? It's all interesting to note. All offers wisdom. If it's control I want, I need to practice letting go. We all do. All of the insights that get wrapped in these moments of transition. And friends, if this is how I react to my daughter going off to college and my husband going on a trip, it's clear to me that I'm in trouble when it comes to larger losses. I know some of you in this room have suffered huge losses. I know some of you have lost parents when you were young, lost children long before it's ever right to lose your children, lost spouses, best friends, siblings. And I know all of you carry the wisdom of all of that with you, and that's a good thing because we will need you. Those of us who haven't been there before. In a culture that runs away from death and from loss and from grief, we need our wise ones with us. And we need the rituals that we have for the transitions of life that acknowledge the fullness of what it means, right? The way we do, the blessing and the burden of a child that we acknowledge when we bless it, and the joy and the wild courage of marriage that we acknowledge when we do those rites of passage, and the challenge and the beauty and the excitement and the danger of transitioning into adulthood that we acknowledge in our coming of age ceremony, and the mourning and the joy that we acknowledge when we officiate over a funeral. But what I realized in thinking about this service is that all of the rituals that we do involve the people in the transitions except death. That person is already gone. We're just holding the people left behind. And so this service and this Sunday is an invitation for me at least, and maybe us, to think about how we regather up the skills that our foremothers and fathers and the wise elders of the past had about what it means to stand with one another as we die, even as we send death out into hospitals and we make it a failure and not just a natural passage, a completion. And that we draw deeply on those who can help us hold one another. Because, my friends, the bowl will break, they'll all break, and the teacups, and we will cease to be in so much that we depend on. And grief will be forever also the mirror of our love. The strange law of the heart that says that the more you and I learn to let go and hold grief, the more we are ready to hold love. And in fact, the more we grieve, the more we have loved. And so we lean into loss. We force ourselves to because we want to love big. Because we need to learn to love big. So as Mary Oliver so rightly says in her poem that we already read once this summer, but here we go, on Blackwater Pond, if you know the words, you can say them with me. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things: to love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing that your own life depends on it, and when the time comes to let it go. To let it go. May we find ways to be fully present at the thresholds of our own lives and one another's. May we be present to the sacred invitations dropped at those thresholds. May we grow wiser and more compassionate as we engage with life's scary impermanence. And may our leanings into life's threshold moments and all that asks and all that it means make us more awake to the blessings of each day and of one another. And may we accompany one another through it all with open hearts and singing and all the deep presence we can find in ourselves. So may it be. Blessed be. I love you all. Don't die before me. Amen.
There's something about music that sometimes feels like a rehearsal for death. Not in a morbid sense, but in the way that it teaches us to surrender to the process, to let each note rise and linger, but then dissolve without clinging to it. A melody is beautiful because it's fleeting. It exists in the tension between presence and absence. In the same way, life's transience is what gives it depth. Death isn't so much an end, but a transition. The last unresolved chord that sends ripples through the silence. Music has always been a companion to these liminal spaces. I remember my mother's lullabies would ease me into sleep, or how dirges or lamenters would escort the dead, and how we might see our hymns that we sing today as an attempt to bridge the seen with the unseen. In many traditions around the world, sound is the thread that connects otherworldly dimensions. Tibetan monks chant the bardo thodol to guide the dying through the in-between worlds. West African drummers play rhythms to summon the ancestors. And even in secular spaces, we turn to music in moments of transformation, birthdays, weddings, nightclubs. Why? Because music doesn't merely illustrate change, it carries us through change. A song is a living process. It breathes and changes and eventually fades away, leaving only memory in its wake. I wonder if the dying hear music we cannot perceive. In seminary, we studied near-death experiences, and often people would describe harmonies beyond earthly scales, a resonance that pulls them towards something vast and nameless. Is this the sound of the soul unraveling from the body? Or is it the auditory echo of consciousness itself vibrating at frequencies only the dying can access? In many Sufi traditions, music and chanting are used to help devotees reach states of ecstasy and dissolve into the self. This is often described as a kind of death, the fana, or annihilation of the ego, that precedes union with the divine. Perhaps death is not silence, but a shift in tone, a movement from one key to another. And what about the spaces between the notes? The Japanese concept of ma, the pregnant pause in music and art, suggests that meaning lives in the gaps. Death, then, might be the ultimate ma, the great inhale between one existence and the next. Now, if I could choose how to die, I would want music, not as a distraction, but as an anchor, a way to remain conscious of the body and as the body releases its final refrain. Because to die well, I think, is to die like a musician, listening, attuned, and unafraid of the silence that follows the last note. After all, does a song ever truly end? Or does it simply become part of the larger resonance, the om, the hum of the universe, the vibration that never ceases but only changes form? Amen, and blessed be.
We have such wise people here with us today who do such amazing work. I had the chance to do some reading and some listening, and so I thought we would ask them a couple questions and let them bring some of that into this space. So thank you all for being willing to be in a moment of conversation. And you all come from first loves and first commitments and have journeyed together, and those first loves are still with you, but brought them into this work at the Center for Conscious Living and Dying. And I think what I would love to hear from you is, what have you learned from doing this work of companioning people across this threshold of dying that has been most important for you?
Thank you for the question.
Or the biggest gift to you?
Biggest gift. So what I have found when people of all ages, young, old, in between, come together to support individuals on this journey that is holy, that is sacred, that is natural, that is inevitable, the journey towards the final breath, is that we really are awakening to the power of love and service in a way where we get to practice every day, every moment, showing up with full love, full presence, and serving in a way that ultimately serves ourselves as we tend to those who are facing this threshold. And it has been profound and life-changing and transformative for so many of us. And in our modern world, we're so divided and separate in many ways and siloed in many ways. To come together in this way is such a gift and is, I believe, is essential in this modern world where things are changing so fast. And how do we remember, return to a way of being in a village-type environment with all the modern conveniences and comforts? So that's the dance, and it's been an awesome ride.
For me, the years I've spent bringing music and sharing music with people at the end of their lives has brought me closer to humanity. It's made me feel a greater connection with humanity. And just getting the great privilege and honor to be with people at that time of their life when so many of the little barriers are down, and it's such a quick and beautiful way to have a soul-to-soul connection with a person, especially when, you know, when there's music and to hear, you know, the music that's been important to people all through their lives and how it's helped them, and to be able to share that with people at that time. It's just been such a great honor, and it's fed my soul. So that's probably the biggest gift for me.
The gift for me is transcends and transmutes everything in my life. It brings everything together, really. The purpose for living comes to light, comes to life in me when I sit with someone in that moment, in those last moments, playing a flute or playing an imbira. I lived for many years in South Africa, 11 years I was based in Southern Africa, and I lived for much of that time in a traditional village. And so I got reprogrammed towards the communal way of living, towards an indigenous knowledge system. And coming back to the United States in 2019, I had a sense that the only way I'm going to survive in this country again is when I find and I'm led into the community that's tending to the rites of passage, because these are the three pillars of humankind and human civilization is tending to birth, to youth coming of age, and to death. I had become so used to this being normal that coming back to a modern society, a fully modernized society, an individualistic society, I didn't know if I was going to make it, right? Right? Like survive it, my if my mind, you know, am I going to lose my mind or something? But then God said, you're going to find this community that's tending to this. And so for me, it's the individual experience of humility and love, of being with someone in the most fragile and vulnerable moment of life. And then it's also seeing what this tending to this right does for the community that has been so ingrained in a certain culture of individualism. Because people begin to shed their veils and their fears and their anxieties. It is the medicine. It is the medicine to tend to this threshold together for our culture. And that's what I love about it. Thank you.
Thank you. I wanted to ask one more question. I was going to ask your advice, and you can still answer this, but I feel like you also brought that even to what you all just said about what advice you'd have for us about how to be with people in that moment when they're facing death. But I think the other question is, why music?
I think your music has been integral to the human experience for as long as there's been grief and laughter. And, you know, for me, I can't imagine music not being a part of you know, the experience of dying and letting go. You know, it goes back so far. You know, it's such a deep part of our heritage, and you know, it's sort of maybe been forgotten until recently. I think it's coming back to our understanding. But for me, you know, music is the way that I feel connected with the people that I love in the deepest way. So if, like, for instance, when my mom died, it was her voice that I was hearing when I was singing, you know. It's songs bring me back to, you know, feeling connected to the people that I've loved who have gone on. We've written songs for people, and these are just such powerful ways to feel the depth of connection, I think. And so I think you got to have music, you know, in all aspects of life, but particularly when we're talking about the end of life.
Yeah. So music as well can be seen as life itself. And I think you, brother, answered this question so profoundly. Can I get a copy of that message that you... You know, why music? It's there. The vibration is the source of our life. It's the first reverberations of consciousness that brings materiality into possibility. And so for me, it's in the gap between sounds, there's also a music. And as I sit with someone who's crossing over, I have to surrender my entire identity. It's like a transcendental meditation process to surrender my individual identity and tap into what is this human needing right now to let go, to help let go. And that's a great gift to experience personally.
Combine the two questions, and I think the invitation with this approach to being with those who are dying is really to trust that you can show up in full presence with love. You don't have to have a degree, credentials. If you've grown up on a farm, you know this natural way of being with those animals and beings that are dying and crossing over. And whatever tools you have, meditation, music, to support you to ground and to be present is really, to me, one of the fundamental ingredients of you know, of being with those who are dying. And yes, there are skills to learn, and you can learn those. But music is a beautiful way of presencing ourselves as we sit at the bedside.
Well.
Mystery.